quite as readily as my students do on two of my favorite topics, which would be economics and theology or ethics. Normally, when people find out that I'm an economist, if they ask me any kind of economic questions, usually something I don't have the foggiest idea about. Usually I get a question about personal finances, and if you could see mine, I don't think you would ask any further questions of me. I would not ask for any advice, certainly. I don't do any prognostications, at least not very well. But I do have an interest in the application of economics to, the application of ethics to economics, and in particular, we're going to look today at what John Calvin had to say about economics. And I hope my little thingy here will work. I've got my computer up here as a backup and sort of a cheat sheet, and I promise I've turned the Wi-Fi off as instructed here today, so I won't shut the bookstore down or whatever it is the problem is causing. John Calvin on economics is a bit of a mixed bag. I don't know, I've been unable to attend the other lectures here because of my teaching duties and other responsibilities, but I imagine most of what you've heard here has been rather of a praiseworthy nature with regards to Calvin. But I'm afraid that I can't be I can't favor Calvin's ideas 100%. Calvin was often inconsistent. He was often wrong. And he was often shockingly wrong. However, he was occasionally right. And I hope that I can show that in those areas where he was occasionally right, he often had a positive impact. Sometimes that was unintentional, and that was mainly from those areas in which he was good, that is, his theology. And furthermore, we can say that Calvin's intellectual descendants improved upon, expanded, and corrected Calvin, and have brought us a body of work today that I think is very useful. Possibly the first work that would come to mind for most when it comes to the connections between Calvinism and economics would be Max Weber's book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And Protestantism, to Weber, led to capitalism by elevating this ascetic stewardship to a virtue for all Christians in their callings, not just a few of the clergy or a group of monks. Your calling could be something that would be quite ordinary. Weber did miss a few things that were quite important. He missed the fact that there are a few countries, I realize that Scotland might not be the best example to bring up in this crowd, but Scotland was relatively undeveloped, we have to admit, and was thoroughly Calvinistic for a number of years, and we cannot neglect that. If Calvinism, one for one, leads to prosperity and the capitalistic society, then we have to do some explaining when it comes to some of these other countries. Also, there were financial innovations. There was a capitalist spirit, if you will, and business success in Roman Catholic areas, in other areas that would not be called Calvinistic or Protestant even. Also, we can find that one can be a Calvinist without being ascetic. It's not uncommon today to see plenty of Calvinists who don't mind driving cars that are less than 20 years old, and there's nothing about Calvinism that requires that kind of asceticism. Now, this fellow here is Adam Smith. Some of you may recognize the famous Scotsman who, though not particularly faithfully religious himself, nevertheless drew from Calvinism, I don't think directly, but indirectly. He grew up in that spirit in Scotland. Murray Rothbard, also no fan of Calvin himself, and in fact quite a critic, said that Calvin's idea of the calling glorified labor and may have contributed to the labor theory of value that has its form in Adam Smith. It's unfortunate that this labor theory of value developed. In fact, when I teach history of economic thought, I try to point out the connections between two people we might regard as being polar opposites, Adam Smith and Karl Marx. Both of these individuals held to a labor theory of value to some extent. And all those people who claim Adam Smith as their patron saint would certainly not hold to the ideas of Marx. There is a common thread. We do know that saving leads to capital accumulation, but saving per se is not a virtue. Can I say that in here? Saving per se is not a virtue. Now, we're in the middle of this economic crisis, and I hope we're in the middle and not the beginning. And we certainly can see where a lack of saving might have contributed to the situation we're now in. But saving for saving's sake is no more virtuous than consumption for consumption's sake. H.M. Robertson argued that Calvinism's encouragement of capital accumulation produced an interest group that was supportive of property rights. Well, that's important because then this group that was supportive of property rights, perhaps in their own self-interest, then put pressure on Protestantism to further emphasize property rights in later iterations of the Protestant ethic. Robertson then is essentially arguing that the doctrine of the calling did not breed a spirit of capitalism, but rather the spirit of capitalism was responsible for a gradual modification of and attrition of that Puritan doctrine that we have associated with Calvin. Now, I'm not asking that you believe Robertson on this, but I'm saying this is one take on Calvinism, that perhaps the cause-effect has been reversed, that rather than Calvinism causing capitalism, it was capitalism that caused this Protestant ethic. I think there are some problems with that idea, but it's worth at least understanding that concept. Ernst Troeltsch argued that the Protestant Reformation resisted modernization, but inadvertently promoted it. He said that one of Calvin's main contributions to modernism was providing a competitor to the Roman Catholic Church. And in doing that, he promoted experimentation in other areas. Robert Nelson, also certainly no friend of Calvin. I promise I do quote a few friends of Calvin eventually. Robert Nelson said that ecclesiastical competition led to these other kinds of social and intellectual competition that brought about some fruit. So it's we've got a set of ideas here that are being advanced by people who are not Calvinists and yet may shed a little light on what we have seen from as far as that connection between Calvinism and capitalism. Here, by the way, is a map of Europe after the Reformation, and you can see the fragmentation, and a lot of that fragmentation religiously led to a fragmentation politically. I would argue that this was a useful phenomenon, because when you get that kind of fragmentation politically, you get a kind of political competition. This is not the time for the rabbit trail that I would very much like to go on, but it is a happy thing when, if you don't like the duke or the king that you are under, you can simply leave and go next door to where the conditions are a little more hospitable. So having that kind of political fragmentation probably contributed to a relative freedom in Europe after the Reformation. So to some extent, I would argue that there is a connection between the there's something to that argument that competition between Protestantism and the Roman Catholic Church did add to economic freedom, although not intentionally. Well, what can we say then about the actual impact of Calvin? This sounds like a conclusion. It's not. I have a long way to go. I would say that market-friendly ideas were already developing elsewhere, and you can certainly see that with the Roman Catholic scholastics in Spain and elsewhere. But Calvin may have contributed in some general ways to the errors that Adam Smith committed. I don't want you to get the misconception that I'm opposed to everything Adam Smith said. I certainly find a few jewels in what he wrote, but in general, I'm not as favorable toward Adam Smith as many other free market-oriented economists might be. There was an overemphasis, I think, on saving in Calvinism, which did promote a capital accumulation, and I would say there was a degree of self-reinforcement to this. But Calvin's theology did promote limitations on government, and we'll see that a little later. And furthermore, Calvin promoted the elimination of usury prohibitions. These are the limitations on interest. And although I don't spend a lot of time in this talk, it's interesting to see the relationship between Calvinism and Protestant communism in other parts of Northern Europe. And we can talk later perhaps about the Anabaptists and the cults in Münster and elsewhere in Europe, where the form of communism that developed there was very radical and quite scary. I just don't spend a lot of time on that here. Gary North, who has written, I think, an important article, essay on the economics of Luther and Calvin, I can point you to that later if you like, says that Calvin had little respect for businessmen in general, to whom he referred as those robbers who hoped for a catastrophe in order to raise the prices of their goods. But as a counterpoint, we have Robert Stivers, who says that Calvin's real world involved shopkeepers, traders, and craftsmen, as well as clerics and academics. He was, Stivers says, relatively free of the medieval distaste for commerce. His world was that of urban commerce, and he affirmed it. Stivers says that the exchange of money and goods was affirmed, and the institution of money itself was not suspect. And North does say a few favorable things about Calvin as well. I don't want to convey the impression that Calvin was anti-merchant. He certainly was not. In fact, you can see this just in the evidence of what happened in Geneva during Calvin's time there. Monter points out that there were 50 merchants in Geneva in 1536, but that number had risen to 180 by the late 1550s. If Calvin was anti-merchant, it's hard to understand how this could have occurred. North says, in Calvin's favor, that he favored the general principle of the covenant, that is, covenanting men should be limited by consciences unrestricted by multitudinous legal pronouncements. He said conscience had more responsibility and fewer guidelines to direct human action. So that's favorable toward a market economy. McGrath goes on to say that a culture of free enterprise flourished in Geneva in large part thanks to Calvin's benign attitude toward economics and finance. And Calvin, as I have said, defended private property against the radical Protestant sects, including the Anabaptists, who might have been the one of the worst groups to advocate a kind of communism. It's an interesting story. I could recommend some readings on that episode later if you like. And then from Calvin himself, we don't have to just look at the evidence of Geneva. We can see what he said in his four last books of the Pentateuch. For it is necessary for the preservation of human society that each should possess what is his own, that some should acquire property by purchase, that to others it should come by hereditary right, to others by the title of presentation. But what is yours is yours. And he says that political government requires that each should enjoy what belongs to him. And Calvin's affirmation of private property was important to some of the royalty in the area who felt somewhat threatened not only by this new Reformation, but also some of the Protestant sects like the Anabaptists who seem to argue for either an anarchy or some kind of a radical communism. Calvin, however, was too inconsistent to be an icon of laissez-faire economic policy. And we see several examples of that. We probably would think nothing of this kind of government intervention today. This is regarded as the norm, but it is, just so you know, this is not laissez-faire economics, or economic policy. Okay. First, we do see that in Geneva there was a hospital supported by the municipal government that was a kind of a charity hospital, but it was supported out of tax funds. There was public education. There were regulations on prices, including limitations on the printers' prices. And printers were an industry that grew fabulously during Calvin's time in Geneva, and yet there were regulations there. Also, I know of regulations on fires and on chimneys, regulations on the recruitment of mercenaries. So we see a number of labor-type regulations as well as something we might regard as a building code, price controls, and, of course, welfare-type activities as well. Calvin objected on moral grounds to labor contracts that did not provide what we today would call a living wage. That's been something of a controversy. It comes up every now and then when a discussion of increasing the minimum wage appears. And you see from Calvin himself, his statement on this, humanity, he says, is recommended to us in general, lest while the poor labor at our service, we should arrogantly abuse them as if they were our slaves, or should be illiberal and stingy towards them, since nothing can be more unjust than that when they have served us, they should not at least have enough to live upon frugally. That is an argument for a living wage. Okay? It's not an argument that says you pay to the person what you have contractually agreed to pay to them. It says you should pay to them what is enough for them to live on, and those are two very different things. But Calvin did stop short of making that a legal obligation. He simply said it's immoral to pay them less than what they need to live on. He did not say that the government should intervene to make it so, at least not that I'm aware. Well, a little digression here on this idea of social justice, which is very much in vogue and has been for some time. I run into this quite frequently with college students who are made to feel that they are not being good citizens if they are not pursuing social justice. And I have no problem at all with justice. I have no problem at all with justice in society, which you might call social justice. But the problem is that this term, social justice, has been turned into something which is, I think, an invalid argument. Do we determine justice by looking at the outcomes or by looking at the process? And that's the question to really ask when we're trying to decide if an action is just or if a society is just. Would you determine whether or not a basketball game were played justly or fairly by looking at the score? Or would you look at how the referees have adjudicated the various, have applied the various rules? Someone who is focused on outcome justice would say, well, the game was unfair if one team had 80 points and the other team had 40 points. And someone who advocates a process justice would say, no, it doesn't matter what the score is as long as everybody was playing by the same rules and as long as the referees were applying those rules fairly. Ronald Stone, an apologist for a version of leftist Calvinism that I sometimes frequently run into, argued that the welfare of the people is a clear responsibility of the government as Calvin understood it. The tendency toward government control of business is clear in Calvin's writings and actions. Tendencies of many later-day Calvinists toward affirmations of laissez-faire economics and social Darwinism do not seem to have a grounding in Calvin. The cruelty of unregulated social Darwinism, I guess regulated social Darwinism would be better, right? Certainly is not consistently compatible with Calvin's teachings. I love those little mishmash words, consistently compatible. So if you find something that's consistent, well, we're not going to talk about that. Francois Dermage says, in opposition to what Stone would have argued, Calvin reminds us that charity does not dispense with justice. His purpose is to condemn judges who want to depart from equity in favor of the poor, in the name of the gospel, and follow out a foolish idea of mercy by favoring the poor. In the name of justice, there should not be any question of providing for the needs of the destitute by causing harm to the wealthy. That does not mean at all that Calvin was somehow opposed to almsgiving. In fact, Dermage goes on to say that the reformer agrees with Paul. While the wealthy have a duty to give alms, one must not compel them to share their possessions. Whatever may be the merit of charity and the concern to free the poor from tyranny, one should not become less upright by even a hair's breadth. So I would say, countering Stone here, Calvin may not have been consistently in favor of laissez-faire policy, but neither was he a socialist. Well, another interesting aspect of Calvin, and one which I believe has been addressed or will be addressed in other talks at this conference, is the relationship between Calvin and limits on the civil magistrate. I don't want to step too much on other people's topics here, but I do want to say a few things here because it is important to economic growth that people enjoy economic freedom. And we can see in Calvin some things that tend toward that or promote that kind of economic freedom. One is the concept of total depravity. Everyone in all their being is tainted or depraved, subject to the influences of sin, and as a result, we would say that applies not only to the governed, but also to the governor. The civil magistrate, therefore, should have a carefully circumscribed power. And we see some things in Calvin that indicate not only that he had some suspicion of the goodwill of the governing authorities and led him also to promote or advocate a separation of powers. I don't believe it's any accident that we see in a predominantly Calvinistic society, in the colonies in America, a constitution which emerged, which promoted that separation of powers as a key part of the formation of our government. Calvin seemed in other respects to favor a government by the enlightened elite, which is a, I would say, dangerous tendency and one which does give the Calvinistic left some ammunition. He did gravitate toward popular election of public officials, and he did not reject monarchy. It certainly would have been unwise for him to reject monarchy, considering that monarchs and lower level royalty were some of his protectors. I think Calvin was certainly a courageous person and would have objected to monarchy had he seen reason in Scripture to do so, but neither he nor I see any reason to object to monarchy per se. He did teach a non-resistance to government, at least early on. You see the resolution on the screen is not real great, but you can see here some burning of some books of Calvin and at least one other reformer. Calvin's publications were so effective, and there were so many of them that people in Roman Catholic areas throughout Europe tried to suppress his writings. There was a tendency among some printers in Geneva to create publications that were extremely small and easily hidden and smuggled throughout Europe so that people around Europe could see Calvin's or read Calvin's thoughts. Reminds me of the Skinny Luke version that missionaries would sometimes carry into areas of the world where Christianity was illegal. This is probably one reason Calvin has been so very successful throughout time, is his propensity to publish so much. Calvin, here's where I have some reservations about another area, I suppose, where I have some reservations about Calvin. He said, even to think of changing the form of government under which one lived was foolish and harmful. And he said further, for since a wicked prince is the Lord's scourge to punish the sins of the people, let us remember that it happens through our fault that this excellent blessing of God is turned into a curse. From his commentaries on Romans. I don't know what you think about that. I have a bit of a problem myself with arguing that whatever tyrant appears on the scene, it's the fault of the people who happen to live under the tyrant. Calvin certainly was no revolutionary. Douglas Kelly said that Calvin was determined to show that true Protestants were loyal to the civil magistrate and were in no sense political revolutionaries. This desire to vindicate fellow evangelicals from the charge of political radicalism is undoubtedly part of the reason why Calvin was exceptionally conservative all of his life in strongly opposing revolutionary movements against bad rulers. Furthermore, Kelly says that Calvin eagerly dissociated himself from John Knox's more radical stand for civil resistance in Scotland in the late 1550s. He said Calvin's thought underwent some evolution on this point in the 1560s during the religious wars in France. The St. Bartholomew's Day massacre occurred, I believe, after Calvin's time, but certainly see the persecution of the Huguenots in France and the other, those religious wars had really kicked off in the early 1560s, and Calvin was witness to some of that. And that may have motivated some change in Calvin's thoughts. This is a woodcut of the massacre of Protestants at Vassy-sur-Blaise in 1562. Apparently some duke was insulted and he sent his troops in. They massacred a number of French Protestants. This is a portrait of St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre of French Huguenots in 1572. This is the point to which the wars had proceeded just within 10 years. And certainly this kind of thing would prompt a little introspection into one's views of the legitimacy of a civil authority that would do this sort of thing. And this is another illustration of the massacre on St. Bartholomew's Day here in Paris. One other area in which Calvin made some contributions, and I think overall positive contributions, is his thought on usury. And I've seen among Christians I respect a variety of views on this subject. There are those who would say that any charging of interest is unbiblical. Others who would advocate some sort of cap on interest rates. I think you'll find the biblical restriction read carefully is one which says that we should, or that in, at the time of the writing, there would be no interest charged to fellow Jews. I think the modern application of that would be don't charge interest on charitable loans to other believers. There's a, I suppose, room for controversy on that, but that's what I would regard as the biblical position. I would say that usury, properly defined, is the charging of interest of any amount where it is forbidden. You do not see in Scripture, as far as I have seen, maybe some of you can correct me on this, but as far as I have seen no cap, no limit on interest. It's either you may charge interest or you may not charge interest, but I don't see you may charge interest of 5% but not 6%. We do see, not that this is a moral argument, but you do see the effect of interest restrictions is the reduction of the availability of funds. This is common to any good or service where a limit is placed on prices. You put a limit on the price, you're going to get less of it. Just as if you put a minimum on the price, you may end up with too much of it. I'm not going to go through all the economic graphs and supply and demand and all that with you, but I'll certainly be happy to draw diagrams to your heart's content, or at least my heart's content, afterward if you like. The medieval argument that Calvin grew up around was that money was sterile and could not produce any kind of return. And it led to the conclusion that any payment on the money, on the use of money, that is interest, necessarily made the borrower worse off. Well, Calvin saw that having money for a time would allow the borrower to buy and sell for a profit before returning the money to the lender. And so Calvin said, as long as this is possible for the borrower to return the money after having made some kind of profit on it, then money's not sterile. He said the profit is not in the money itself, but in the return that comes from its use. Now, Calvin, again, was inconsistent on this. He did want restrictions on interest. One thing, he did not want any interest charged on loans to the poor. I think that's understandable why he would argue that. I think there's at least some kind of connection there to biblical law. He also wanted to cap interest rates, though, at 5%. This later changed to 6 2/3%. Not sure where he got that, although 5% was kind of the norm for an interest rate cap at his time. Martin Luther also advocated a 5% cap on interest rates. If this were a conference that was on Luther rather than Calvin, I think I could show that Luther's economics were quite a mess, more so, I think, than Calvin's. But this is one area where Luther tended to support the common limitations on interest. Calvin also said, of course, not wanting in any way to suggest that the civil laws should not be followed. He argued that any civil law restricting interest payments should be followed. And finally, this is a bit puzzling, no one should be a professional moneylender. Any bankers here? No one wants to admit it now. Okay. Well, that's understandable. Maybe there are some former bankers here. No. All right. Well, it fell to some of Calvin's followers to correct for some of these errors or shortcomings in Calvin. One was Claude Salmase, also known as Salmasius, who lived from 1588 to 1653. Salmase justified not only professional money lending, but also interest-bearing loans to the poor. And he saw, and as an economist I can see the point here for this second item, more money lenders means more competition, which means lower rates. So if you have more professional money lenders, then that means that would help the poor. So contrary to Calvin, we should encourage people to become money lenders because that means that interest rates will drop, and if you do need to borrow money, you can do so at a lower rate. Salmase must have been a real trenchant sort of person, crusty perhaps, because we see him saying things like, "I would rather be called a usurer than be a tailor." I don't know what to say to that, but Murray Rothbard, commenting on Calvin's usury position, said the odd result of Calvin's thought was that in hedging his explicit pro-usury doctrine with qualifications, and I would say, Rothbard, you shouldn't have called it usury, you should have called it interest. Usury is interest that you shouldn't be charging. Okay, so I think what Calvin's saying is not all interest is usurious. Rothbard says that in hedging his explicit pro-usury or pro-interest doctrine with qualifications, Calvin in practice converged on the views of such scholastics as Beale, Sumenhart, Cahayton, and Eck, or Ike. Calvin began with a sweeping theoretical defense of interest-taking and then hedged it about with qualifications. The liberal scholastics began with the prohibition of usury and then qualified it away. They came to the same position. I was in a talk yesterday on healthcare economics, and the speaker was saying that in practice, worldwide, the treatment of health care, the intervention of government in health care is converging, that nations such as Canada that have nationalized medical care are starting to allow some private insurance, and nations like the United States, which depend largely on private insurance, are starting to move toward nationalization. I don't really... Well, I'll say that for another day. But Rothbard goes on to say that Calvin's bold break with the formal ban on interest was a liberating breakthrough in Western thought and practice. And for someone like Rothbard, maybe some of you are not familiar with Rothbard, but for him to say that is a big deal, because Rothbard was certainly no fan of Calvin. Well, in conclusion, the words everybody's waiting for, what Calvin did contribute to economics and policy were, first, this doctrine of total depravity, which led to a separation of powers and limits on the civil magistrate. Also, an emphasis on vocational success and saving, which created capital and therefore created a group interested in the preservation of that capital and the protection of property. Also, Christian liberty, freedom of conscience, which removed some of the barriers to the freedom of contract, very important to economic freedom. And he, though he had some moral objections to the terms of some contracts, as we've seen with labor contracts, he would have wanted contracts to provide a living wage. But he did not automatically conclude that because this thing was immoral, that it should therefore be illegal. And that is an important distinction that I think far too many miss today. Just because something is immoral, now, I don't think that paying less than a living wage is immoral, for the record. But just because something is immoral does not mean that it should be illegal. We have spheres of authority. We have jurisdictions. Not everything falls under the jurisdiction of the state. And I think that that is a point of view which Calvinism reinforces. And then finally, we have these limits on usury prohibition from Calvin, which were expanded upon later on. Well, I'm told that there was to be some time for questions, comments, egg throwing. What's that?
Later this afternoon.
Okay, all right. I'm able to stay through lunch at least. I have, unfortunately, for you, maybe not unfortunately for you. Very self-flattering. I have to deliver this same paper at a conference in Alabama for which I'm leaving later today. So I don't know if the schedule allows any time. Okay. All right. Well, very good question. I have assumed here that there's a link between Calvin's personal views and what actually occurred in Geneva. That, frankly, would take some further research on my part to find those connections. All I can say at this point is that Calvin was certainly, along with Farrell, a very influential figure in Geneva. That there were certainly things that went on in Geneva that he would not have approved of. But that doesn't mean that I can hold him responsible for whatever nonsensical policies might have existed in Geneva. That's a gap in my paper. I would like to resolve that. At this point, I'm merely assuming a connection which, as you say, may not exist. No. As far as I can tell, he did not object. We do see, and I did not mention this in the presentation, but it's in my paper, the Bourse Francais, French is always a problem for me. Bourse Francais, which was a fund, I can say that. It was a fund supported largely by French refugees, some of them quite wealthy, to Geneva, which was a private charity that operated alongside this hospital and provided for the poor, orphans, widows without that government support. And Calvin did, in his will, contribute personally to that fund. So we do at least see that. But what I'm getting out of Calvin is really more of a John Stuart Mill type of conservatism. It's pragmatic. It was it allowed for a substantial amount of government intervention, probably not nearly as much as we're accustomed to today here in the U.S., but a substantial amount. Other questions? Maybe I can clarify that further. Yes. Whose job that would be?
Right. You had mentioned that if the wealthy were obligated in some sense, but not legally.
Yes. Well, he clearly, that this objection being understood, there was this hospital that would have run off of tax revenues, so to that extent, the contributions toward the poor would have had an element of coercion in them with the hospital. But
I guess maybe in the hospital, but hospital care, but in other ways, would it be the church's responsibility or the state?
One thing I found in doing the research on this was that it's difficult to really be clear on the responsibilities of the state and the responsibilities of the church. And we see in some Calvinistic areas where, for example, church attendance was something that had a civil sanction applied to it. It was a fuzzier boundary than I think we're used to today. Calvin would say, I believe, that the responsibility is on the church primarily, and on individuals, the almsgiving that we've talked about, that families, of course, ought to be the first recourse for people who find themselves in financial need. These are the spheres of authority and help that we see from Scripture, and I don't think Calvin would have had any objection to. Sure. It is difficult, and when someone can go to the state and get aid without a whole lot of strings attached, and or go to the church and get aid, and then the church is going to expect you to do certain things in response, demonstrate your faithfulness in some areas. There's a clear tendency for people to go toward the state. And that handicaps, I think, effective charity. I think the best thing the church can do is encourage families to provide for their own, as Paul says. That should be the first recourse. So within the body, at least, we should be able to say, if you find yourself without a job, look first to your family and see what aid you can get there. And if the family is incapable or unwilling, then the church and state some sort of distant third option. I'm not nearly as good on how to make these things happen. I tend to be one of these idealists. I would say, well, this is this is what ought to be, but I'm not very good at plotting the course to get there. I wish I were better at that. Maybe other questions, which I...
We do have some questions submitted writing now, so stay here, please.
Yeah.
Just work through them. We'll have to finish in approximately 5 minutes.
Okay, where in Calvin's works do you find his teachings on economics? Probably the best thing for me to do in answer to this is just provide you with a copy of my paper, and you've got all the end notes there, which would not be a comprehensive selection, but you could find that. It tends to be scattered, a lot of it in his political work, and just mine my end notes, and that might be the best way to do that. Given the shortage of time, I want to get through as many of these as we can. What was his view on taxation? Any limits? I don't know of any limits. Given his view of the civil magistrate and his non-revolutionary tendencies, it seems that he would say, pay taxes. Clearly, if taxes are 90%, we've got a problem. You tithe, you pay the government, and then you starve. And there's got to be some sort of limit, but I'm not aware of any place where Calvin said this is the limit, 30% or whatever it was. It doesn't mean that Calvin didn't say something, but there's a vast amount about Calvin I do not know. Can you please provide several examples of dominant Orthodox Roman Catholicism areas also being vibrant in capitalism? Murray Rothbard, who leaned toward, I think that's most he ever did, but leaned toward Catholicism, did bring up in his book on the history of economic thought before Adam Smith, which I believe is available now in full text online. He mentioned the Spanish scholastics and a number of other Catholics that he regarded as being important, and, of course, Orthodox promoted capitalistic ideas, or ideas that were at least consistent with markets. And so I would refer you to that book by Rothbard on the history of economic thought. The Mises Institute, I think I just saw this a couple of weeks ago, where they posted what used to be a $200 two-volume work online, and I think you can now get that for free. And I got a good bit of the material from that.
We're going to have to cut it off at that point. You might talk with the professor individually if you have further concerns that we could not address.